Working Cows Podcast, Episode 84.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. Recording this intro from my closet in my bedroom because there's a blizzard outside and I'm not going anywhere today. I am excited to bring this episode to you with John Locke. John is from the Locke Division of the J.D. Hudgens Ranch on the Gulf Coast of Texas. They are producing Brahman feedstock and F1 females. Before we get going with John, I do want to remind you of the opportunity coming up Tuesday, April 16th at 8 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. You will be able to join us for an episode with Beef Chain. Just think about some of the potential use cases for this. You could even send out a card with a steak for somebody who ordered one in an urban context, and it could have on it, this animal spent this many days of its life on grass, or this animal spent this percentage of its life on pasture, or this animal converted this many tons of carbon in its lifetime. So good stuff, really excited about that, and I would encourage you to check out the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/84, and there will be a link to a Facebook event there for the upcoming webinar, and I would encourage you to put it on your calendar and plan to join us Tuesday, April 16th at 8 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. And really excited to talk to John, potential benefits of Brahman seed stock for commercial ranches all over the United States and other places. So, John, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Thank you, Clay. It is an extreme honor to be here talking with you and to have been asked to be a part of Working Cows.
You're part of the J.D. Hudgens network of ranches, and I would just like to hear a little bit about the history of your family's division of that operation. If you could just share kind of how that was formed and where you guys started out.
Sure. So we've got a long history on the Texas Gulf Coast. I guess it was my great-great-great-grandfather. I always have to count those greats. He settled this area in 1839. And as you can imagine, the environment here is pretty rough. Imagine 1839 with no air conditioning and mosquitoes and insects and disease and all that. And from our early history ranching in this area, the need was realized to have some form of cattle that would adapt and be able to thrive in this climate. And that led us to Brahman cattle. My great-grandfather created the J.D. Hudgens Partnership in 1908 with his children. And they were a large agribusiness family that farmed and ranched and had a store here in Hungerford and all that good stuff. But the Brahman cattle have pretty much been the mainstay of the ranch, and we've shifted to that direction. I guess 1915, they really got serious about the Brahman business. And so as we progressed and the business got very large and I guess harder to manage, what they did was they incorporated it in 1962, and the five original families each got a division. So as it exists today, it's basically a family marketing co-op. We all brand the Half Circle L brand. This is a J.D. Hudgens family brand, and we all raise our own cattle with our own style of management and bring them together and co-mingle them under the J.D. Hudgens brand and offer them to our customers.
And who are your customers? Is it a feedlot? Are you guys taking them to finish? Who's the typical customer of a J.D. Hudgens calf?
So we are a seed stock producer. You know, 95% of what we do is dealing in genetics, and we have a very diverse customer base. A lot of people in the United States have a hard time understanding the need for Brahman cattle, but if you look at global beef production, I think 2/3 of all beef cattle in the world have some level of Bos indicus blood. because of the relation to the equator and where most of your grasslands are and the tougher environments. So we have a large international customer base, and we also have a large domestic customer base, mainly along the Gulf Coast, you know, Florida to Texas, and we have some customers in California, and surprisingly, you'd even see a few Brahmins in Oregon, and some people have them up north. But we do everything from F1 production, which is the queen of cow country in the South, is a Brahmin with anything F1 female, and that's probably our bread and butter. And then we move up from there, and we supply genetics and, you know, for purebred operations and higher end registered operations as well, and then internationally.
So I had Johann Zietzman on episode 51 of the Working Cows podcast, and he blew my mind when he said that the most heat stressed cattle he's seen anywhere in all of his travels are in the northern part of North America. Yep. And that's because we're running cows that aren't necessarily adapted to this environment. And so could you make the case for incorporating some Bos indicus into even northern cattle, or is that something that you would encourage people to consider?
Absolutely. And, you know, everybody kind of looks at you a little cockeyed whenever you suggest that. But the thing you have to consider is that Brahmin blood goes a long way. So we love our registered Brahmins for this environment because it's very harsh. But if you consider putting a quarter Brahmin in some of those northern cattle, you get a pretty good hyper vigor kick, but you get a good deal of heat tolerance from that. And just from the standpoint of longevity, insect resistance to flies and other parasites, and especially the heat tolerance. So I could make a great case for that. And I think you're seeing more and more people experiment with it. We've increased our sales to Arkansas and Missouri recently and Oklahoma. And so you're kind of seeing it creep up there. I think when you get pure Brahmins in that situation, and then even in the extreme situations when you get half-bloods, they might not do as well in the cold, and you could have some issues. But that the quarter blood female should be everywhere in North America, really.
Yeah, I like it. I'm a fan. So I'd like to see more experimentation with different bloodlines. You know, what are some of the characteristics of a quarter Brahmin or the calf out of a quarter Brahmin female? Would they, you know, would they feed out well and all those things as well?
They would. Historically, Brahmins have a bad rap for carcass quality and for disposition. And what most people probably don't understand is Brahmins are highly, highly intelligent. And I laugh, and I'll probably get flack for saying this, but I say, you know, any dummy can work a Hereford. You actually have to be smarter than the cow to work Brahmins. And it's just all about paying attention to cattle. And really and truly, it's about good stockmanship. And I'm a big fan of effective stockmanship, and have been studying that for years. And it's so applicable to dealing with Brahmin cattle. So to answer your question, that'd probably be the first thing is there is a disposition concern, but it also works to your advantage because you get a positive behavioral benefit from having that Brahmin blood. On the carcass side of things, we've got a lot of research and even purebred Brahmin carcass evaluation projects where our carcasses are great. They might take a little bit longer on feed, but they're very, very efficient. Feed efficiency is amazing. Obviously, if you're feeding them through the summer, you get a real benefit there. They're not going to go through as much stress. Sickness and death loss is very, very minimal. You're not going to see them grade. For the most part, you're not going to see high percentage Brahmins grade 90% choice or prime. They're a little bit leaner product. But for a lot of markets, that actually fits. You know, when you got people that are fat conscious. And you'll get, I've spoken to people that have done the research with very large numbers. You get a 25% increase in longevity with a quarter blood. You don't even have to go to the half Brahmin. So that's a big deal when you're talking about low input cattle and keeping those females around for a long time.
Could you talk a little bit about the fly resistance aspect of this? We had an actual wet, by our standards, summer last year, and everywhere you went in western South Dakota, there was just cows balled up in the corner trying to fight flies for each other. And could you talk a little bit about how that works in the Brahmin bloodlines and the benefits of the Bos indicus and some of those things?
So purebred Brahmin, the main thing you got to think about those, the reason why they're heat tolerant is because they have the ability to sweat. Bos indicus cattle can sweat. They don't have to give off heat through panning. Along with that sweat, they have a natural substance called sebum that they secrete from their skin, and it's a natural insect repellent. They also have a subcutaneous muscle layer, and they can twitch their skin like a horse can. And so those things help. Now, unfortunately, I can't tell you, I'm sure the research is out there, how much of that carries through on that quarter bud. I know that a lot of it does, but those are probably their main defenses. They just seem to be naturally a lot better equipped to cope with those flies. I'm not going to say the flies aren't there, but they don't seem to affect them as bad.
When do you guys sell bulls?
And we have an internet sale coming up April 16th through the 18th at www.cattleinmotion.com. It's the J.D. Hudgens Traditions Spring Select Sale. And I think it's the sixth one that we've had, but we sell bulls private treaty every day. We have people walk in off the street with no warning. We have people pick up the phone and call and buy 30 bulls over the phone. But this internet sale format is kind of a marketing effort, and we sell kind of some select animals in that. We do that in the spring and the fall, but April 16th through the 18th is the next one we have coming up.
Well, I appreciate you entertaining my line of questioning here about the Brahmin business, but you also have a very interesting family history as far as the management transition of your specific division of the J.D. Hudgens brand. Could you talk a little bit about the transition of management and that what that has kind of kicked off in your family's operation?
In my family, yes. So we're a very large, diverse family. I think there's 18 full-time family members here involved in the management of the ranch across 8 different divisions. And it's pretty diverse. I mean, you've got management styles from one extreme to the other. And we've kind of gone a very different route in the last few years. My family went through a significant succession event in 2010, got hit with the 2011 drought. Somehow at that same time, I wound up at a place where I heard Dave Pratt speak and really got my mind going about how we were going to manage our division. We basically ended up with the same overheads and the same families to feed with half the cattle that we had before and only a quarter of the land base. So we were pushed and kind of challenged to figure out how we were going to make this work. You know, it was get a job in town and do it as a hobby, or just back your ears and figure it out. And so we've been kind of pushing on it ever since then. I went to the ranching for profit school in August of 2011, and it just really, you know, opened my eyes and my mind and started to change the way I saw things and changed the way I thought about things. So we've moved into full-blown, you know, we're mob grazing registered cattle with multiple daily moves. We've somewhat changed our marketing plan, and we have to fit in the framework of J.D. Hudgens and the structure. And so that's very challenging. And it's challenging to have to think about customer service, breeding registered cattle, and developing your genetics while you're developing a mob grazing program and concentrating on what's most important. And I think my favorite quote probably of all time, and I picked it up in the ranching for profit school, is the things that matter most must never be at the mercy of the things that matter least. And It sounds great and it's awesome, but figuring out what matters most is the trick. And so we spent a lot of time, you know, working through those things and trying to figure out where we have to put our effort and what we really need to be concentrating on, what matters most.
And we don't have to go into the necessary ins and outs of the the succession event, but was there anything that you learned from that succession event about how you would structure your succession from here on out, as far as protecting the land base and the cattle?
Absolutely. And I probably get criticism for having this opinion, but after watching my dad, you know, work through the business and basically hoping that everything would work out okay in the end and that everybody would get along and, you know, everybody would get what they wanted. The most important thing is communication. There was some real mistakes that were made earlier on when we went through that, that if everybody would have just understood where the other person was coming from, but, you know, people didn't want to show their hand. They thought this was going to happen, but they didn't want to question you. Is this your intentions? And so if we would have communicated better while you were going through it, but it would have been a lot better and would have helped better preserve the family dynamic. With that being said, we're all, you know, good now. Everybody gets along and, you know, it's fine. But mainly, I grew up in an environment and a culture where if you're born, you get part of the ranch. And it really made me think long and hard about that. And I went to my dad and I said, hey, if that's the way you want to do it, this is yours to pass on. But I need to know now so that we can do things differently. And we basically made the decision that whatever happens on the ranching end is between me and my dad and my sisters. I have three sisters. They're entitled to, you know, my mother's inheritance on her side. And it was a difficult conversation to have with my sisters, but they were understanding. And, you know, you just can't keep cutting that pie up. Obviously, we want to grow the ranch and we want to be at a point to where if all three of my daughters want to come back, that'd be fantastic. But at the end of the day, it's about having a business that really is a business that supports a family and provides for the community around you. And if you just keep chopping it up, it's pretty tough to do.
So you mentioned that you are mob grazing registered cattle, and that's not typical of any registered operation that I'm aware of. Can you talk about some of the reasons why people don't typically mob graze registered cattle?
Sure. I think there's probably a lot of reasons. The biggest thing would be the genetic management, I think. And, you know, you have your breeding herds and you have certain sires you want to use. And that's a big challenge. And it took me a while to break through that paradigm. And that kind of goes back to the things that matter most. And I finally decided that it was going to be about the biology, you know, the microbes, the biology, the grass, the soil, then the grass, then the cattle. But it also goes back to the people. You know, people have to be number one. For simplicity's sake, to concentrate on what we thought was the most important thing, instead of looking at that situation with your typical mindset and saying, well, we can't manage these genetics, so we're just not going to deal with it, I made the decision that we're going to figure out how to manage those genetics, maintaining one mob year round. And that's challenging. That's the number one challenge. But basically, we can do 30 days of AI and then put out several bulls and have a multi-sired herd. That's something that, you know, a lot of people look at like that's backwards. But we're letting nature make more of the decisions on what genetics get propagated. And I like that. And I know that's contradictory because with AI, you're not really doing that. You're making all those decisions, but it plays into your decision making, I guess you could say. So, and then just as far as marketing, I'd never had customers come out and see what we're doing for the most part for several years. And now I've gotten to the point where the cattle are performing so much better and I almost get a kick out of seeing people's reaction to, wait a minute, you've got young calves, old calves, replacement heifers, recipient cows. And a lot of people can't cope with it. They just look at it and they're like, this is a mess. But I like it. You know, to me, it's a beautiful mess. And there's a herd dynamic there. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on with that mob. And I'm kind of trying to use it in a way to open some people's eyes, I guess. But that's a big challenge, too. When people come and they look and they're like, man, this guy's, he's just got a mess out here. And you're trying to market cattle to those people. But for the most part, the cattle are performing well enough to where it works.
Yeah, I want to hit that cattle performance piece. Can you talk about, have there been any noticeable changes? I think if we haven't filled in the gaps on this timeline, you've been doing this for about 7 years. So have you noticed any changes in the cattle themselves as far as conformation and some of those things as a result of this move and letting nature do some of the selecting?
I have. I'd say somewhat. It might still be too soon to really say. And that's my big challenge with being relatively small. I mean, we're running about 200 to 220 head. And we need, 100 more animals in the purebred system to really be making some significant movements on selection pressure in my mind. So, but we have seen some things that, some cattle can't hack it. Some cattle can. And I'll make this point now that I'm a little bit off the main path on the grazing management and the mob grazing. And this is probably a good time to interject this, but I'm a pretty strong believer in selective mob grazing. And I know a lot of people are just hardcore non-selective. You've got to make them, they say, clean it up or whatever. And we don't need to get into all the specifics and the details of why, but with selective grazing, animal performance is from what I've seen, because I've tried it both ways, non-selective and selective, animal performance is huge. And if you're trying to make money with your cattle and they're not performing well, you're going to have a hard time. And a lot of people preach that, well, once you get the soil built, then your cattle will start performing well. But what happens in the meantime? And so that's kind of been one of my big challenges. And I try to challenge people on that frequently, because there's a pretty sharp divide there. I could go into all the details, but I've been a follower of Ian Mitchell Ennis for several years, or for a couple of years now. And he's a little different on that. And it just really, it seems to work for me. I've done it both ways. I've done, long rest periods, shorter rest periods, with lots of recovery. And it just what we're doing now seems to be working for us as far as animal performance is concerned and plants.
That was my next question, is the soil health benefits with this different style of management. What are you mentioned earlier that you wanted to start to love the microbes and the soil and then the grass and then the cattle, and that's kind of basically flipping that on its head in a lot of operations, that we're more concerned about cattle than we are about grass, and definitely maybe not even considering the soil. So can you talk a little bit about the change in your plant base and some of those things as a result of this?
We're basically what most people call improved pasture or tame grass situation. And I've been doing this for years, and I've just started to kind of realize that some of the terminology that people use, and it's kind of hard to call those grasses improved whenever they're really not an improvement over what nature gave us for the most part. But a lot of people tell me with what we're doing with our selective grazing that we're going to go back to a monoculture, and that it's not going to be good for plant diversity, and all of these things can't happen. And I don't think they really understand it, or they haven't seen it in the style that we're doing it. I guess style is a poor choice of word, but so we've seen an increase in diversity. We've seen natives start to come in, kind of mid-successional grasses, even a few later successional grasses. And so the diversity has improved. I think that's helped the plant or the animal performance, because of their ability to express their nutritional wisdom more and have more to select from. The overall health of the cattle seems to be better, and the soil's improving. We're in a pretty different situation than most people. It's harder probably to build organic matter in this area than it is in some areas, and with a high rainfall and lower quality grasses. But we're seeing all the indicators that nutrient density of the grass is up. We're building soil aggregate. Biologically, we're seeing neat things happen, like dragonflies and butterflies and predator insects and all of that stuff. And it seems like the system is just continuing to get more resilient the more we get into it.
Can you talk a little bit about the mechanics of the daily moves or more than daily moves, I guess? What does that exactly look like as far as throughout the year, throughout the course of the year and some of those things?
So we've kind of developed, I know a lot of people cringe when you call it a system, but we've kind of developed our own system, and it's adaptive, and it changes quite a bit throughout the year and sometimes even day to day. And I get a lot of people come just get a snippet of what we're doing, and the first thing they say is, wow, sure seems complicated. When you get into it and you actually see it and you experience it, it's really not complicated at all, which fascinates me because, you know, in conventional agriculture, it seems like the more you want to do, the better you want to perform, the more complicated everything gets and the more inputs and the more money and everything else. And to me, it really feels like the more steps we take, the simpler things get, which is, you know, a pretty awesome thought. So, you know, I've got an employee here that within 90 days, she had no cattle experience. And within 90 days, I was leaving the country for 2 weeks and she was managing everything by herself. And so it can't be that complicated is what I'm trying to say. And it goes back to that, you know, the things that matter most and really having your priority right. So basically what we do is we let cattle performance indicate what we should be doing with the grass. And if the cattle are grazing properly and they're balanced, then they will be performing well, but the grass will be performing well as well also. And that might be a hard concept for some people to get their minds wrapped around, but we'll know what's going on basically from experience during a certain time of year. And we'll know that this mob should be across this many acres in this day. And so we can set them up in the morning. Sometimes it takes us an hour, sometimes an hour and a half. And we use timer release gates throughout the day with bungees on them, similar to a bat latch. And we kind of set a benchmark. So our benchmark normally is 250,000 pounds density. And so the cattle will graze at that density all day, moving away from the water source for the most part, and with no back fence. And we'll even put a game camera on them. We might set 4 or 5 timers in the morning and let them go and, you know, check their moves with the game camera so we don't have to spend a lot of time there. And then normally we'll be on basically the same rest period, or not rest period, but the same graze period, but we'll watch the cattle. And if they're not full at the end of the day, if something's changing in their manure, you know, then we might modify something for the next day. So, and the fascinating thing about that to me is we don't methodically intend to change our rest period depending on the weather and lack of rainfall. But if you pay attention to the cattle and this style of management, they will change the rest period for you. So once it gets drier, I guess the grass gets a little stronger, the cattle fill up a little faster, and you say, well, maybe they don't need quite as many acres tomorrow. And then the next thing you know, you went from a 20-day rest period to a 40-day rest period without intentionally doing it. And that's been a pretty neat thing for me to see.
Cool. You mentioned a few different times that you've had influence of Ian Mitchell Innes, and he is going to be at your place in late April. Can you talk a little bit about that seminar that he's going to be putting on, and it's going to be an opportunity to kind of see some of this in action, I'm assuming?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Really proud to have Ian Mitchell Innes coming April 23rd and 24th in Hungerford, Texas, to put on a 2-day workshop. And Ian turned on a lot of light bulbs for me when I was kind of going through a little bit of a wreck whenever I went to his workshop in 2017. And everything he said, it was kind of like the first time I heard Dave Pratt talk. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, never thought about that. And so we immediately started kind of adopting his style of grazing. And so we had him out to consult last year, made a couple of tweaks that made a huge difference in our operation. And I know a lot of people that follow Ian as well. And he's really helped them. And so I've really appreciated the opportunity that he's given us to host a workshop here and have people look at what we're doing. And to me, it's just all about challenging those paradigms and just taking a look at different stuff. And I have people all the time that say, hey, you've got this grazing thing figured out. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't know what I said to give you that impression, but I don't. It's kind of like marriage, you know. You think you've got women figured out, and then just wait 5 minutes, and you'll realize, whoops. So you've got to constantly learn, and you've got to constantly learn what you need to learn, and learn what to observe. And so I'm just real happy to have Ian come and continue the learning. And the coolest thing about it is we got some really neat people coming. Sage Askins coming, Toby Holstead. There's some of our EL Executive Link members that are going to be here. Might even have an Australian here. And so the networking that you get and the ability to sit around at lunch and talk to people about what they're doing and get ideas and feedback and then go visit their place in the future, that's really exciting to me as well.
I'm reasonably certain this will be episode 84 of the Working Cows podcast, so I'll throw a link in the show notes page at workingcows.net/84 to that resource, to that opportunity to join you guys down there. But you can go ahead and share it now. Where should I send people?
That's a good question. Probably the best thing for people to do is look me up on Facebook. My Facebook name is John Coleman Locke, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, and Locke is L-O-C-K-E, or they can email me at johnclocke@hotmail.com.
Okay. We'll have links to that in the show notes page. And then you also have a seminar of your own coming up in Florida, is that right?
That's right. It's not really mine. I'm going to blame it all on Dallas Mount. And so Dallas Mount's going to be the instructor, and I'm going to assist Dallas. These sort of subtropical environments that we're part of are pretty different. And going back forever, seems like all the emphasis is on native range and, you know, further north and those sorts of things. And I think we're pretty unique and got a different environment and different challenges. And so Dallas asked me to assist him in teaching that class in Florida. And it's going to be real fun. It's going to be a very interactive two-day workshop at one of our Executive Link members' ranches. They have an Eventbrite set up for that, so I can share that. It's going to be May 1st and 2nd. I believe Branford, Florida is the location.
Yep. I will put a link to that in the show notes page. And I was looking at flights down there, and it's right near a pretty major airport, not very far away. So we'll have links to all that at the show notes page at workingcows.net/84. John, I really appreciate your time today. Some really, really good stuff. Anything else, any other resources you'd like me to share there at the show notes page?
Well, I guess just from the Brahmin side of things, if people want to go to www.jdhudgens.com, Brahmin.org, and to learn more about Brahmins, I think that Brahmins have a unique place in the industry. There's always going to be a need for them. And like we mentioned earlier, people underestimate the benefits of just having a quarter Brahmin in your herd. So I challenge people to, you know, if you're having a problem with heat tolerance and insects and maybe even the intelligence of your cattle, I'll catch some flack for saying that. But, you know, look at Brahmins and consider what they could do for your herd.
Very good. John, really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Clay. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to visit with you. Thank you for what you're doing as well.
It's my pleasure. Good stuff there with John. Really excited about that episode, and I would encourage you to consider what Brahmin Genetics could do for your herd and maybe get in touch with John for sure. Check out his bull sale, as I said, Tuesday, April 16th, and that will be linked at the show notes page, workingcows.net/84, as well as the Facebook event for our upcoming webinar, also Tuesday, April 16th at 8 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. You'll be able to join us for that and talk to the people in charge of Beef Chain and get some feedback from them and ask them questions and see how they are putting it to use already and some different ways that you could be putting it to use on your operation. Probably the next episode I'll get out is an episode with Cody Creelman about castration, believe it or not. And we're going to have all vets all the time here on the Working Cows podcast for a couple of episodes. If I do get another episode out other than those two, it would be an episode on
a couple of episodes on financial planning and some of those things that I've got recorded, just some longer episodes, more like webinars in and of themselves, just me asking questions after a couple of real smart guys in the financial realm take us to school, if you will. So either way, be on the lookout for that, and make sure you're subscribed to the Working Cows podcast at workingcows.net/subscribe. So if I do put out an episode between Mondays, you don't miss it. There will be a link to that in the show notes page of that as well, workingcows.net/84. And whatever the episode ends up being, I look forward to seeing you real soon.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.